Thank you for joining me on EQ Above IQ, Parenting with Emotional Intelligence and Healing the Inner Child. My name is Trina Casey and I'm your host. I have the pleasure of introducing Geraldine Moodley. Jerry is her nickname. Most people call her G. She is Dutch, Australian, South African, and of mixed ethnic origin, which makes intercultural relationships a field she knows very well. She's a human rights lawyer, a mediator, and has 25 years combined experience in customer relations, human security, training, project management, campaign and brand development, corporate social responsibility, you name it, she's done it. And the most important thing that she loves about is human rights advocacy and equal right advocacy. She is all about diversity and inclusion holistically and in relating to interpersonal communication and organization development. She just wants everybody to respect each other. And this is part of the reason why I am having her on EQ Above IQ, Parenting with Emotional Intelligence and Healing the Inner Child. And we're going to talk to Geraldine about her experiences and what motivated her to do all that she's done as a human rights advocate and lawyer. And she's going to give us some great insight on what we can do as individuals to move the importance of equality and human rights to the forefront of the dialogue and how we can do that in an emotionally intelligent way. Thanks for joining me. Hello, Geraldine. Jerry.
Hello, Trina.
Thank you for joining this episode of EQ Above IQ, Parenting with Emotional Intelligence and Healing the Inner Child.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jerry, I'm just going to ask you to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Okay. Long story. Where to begin? I'm by heart and soul, a human rights lawyer. And in the capacity of a human rights lawyer, I've carried out lots of different kinds of roles in my life that have been related to human rights and human safety, from security all the way to into business now in the sense of diversity, inclusion, and leadership. And that's where I've taken it out of coming back out of South Africa, working across Africa. I've brought now my experiences in terms of organizational development and knowledge to create equality in the workplace through diversity, inclusion, and leadership training and advice.
Wow, that's great. And I think that is such a necessary role.
Yeah, yeah, right, I mean, now.
We need, and right now, the current climate, definitely. I think that, I mean, had something like that been established in most of the policing organizations in the world, I think we'd have a lot less problems, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I just think that we've signed a lot of international conventions, signatories of many countries all around the world. And in signing all these conventions and treaties, it's quite a state responsibility for actually our politicians to have given effect to all of that. I think that's where it's been. It's always been in word, but it's never been translated to practice.
Yes.
So part of the work that I'm doing now is trying to translate human rights, whether it is within the workplace in terms of labor rights, or whether, like, we look at the place that I was born, Durban, South Africa. The Durban Plan against Racism was signed in 2001, I think. Mm-hmm. And I don't think many countries have given form to how that should be working. And that was almost 20 years ago.
Wow.
So I'm trying to give form, in fact, to international law in which our governments don't do. So
yes,
the legal basis in which I do everything exists. It's not just a movement. It's not just an equal rights movement, an emancipation mm-hmm. movement, a women's movement, diversity movement. It's actually law. But it's just I'm giving it form because nobody else is giving it form.
Okay. And I one of the treaties that I've studied is the Children's Rights mm-hmm. Treaty. And I realized that, you know, the UN signed this in the early 90s or mm-hmm. actually the late 80s, right?
Yeah.
And that there's only two countries that are not a part of that. Mm-hmm. And United States is one of them. Mm-hmm. I was floored that the Child's Rights Treaty was not signed by the U.S., but it also explains a lot of why the level of education has gone down and but wow.
Yeah.
It's kind of blind.
We thought that under Barack, actually, that would have, a lot of things would have been signed. Mm-hmm. But remember, America in itself, irrespective of the president, and this is the greater concern, I think, in the United States, mm-hmm. is it's holding some kind of bastion that we're not aware of. I mean, even treaties like for the International Criminal Court, it's not been signed. You can't take America for its crimes against humanity that happened in Afghanistan, cannot even be prosecuted. And there's much more. There's Guantanamo and a whole lot. So America absolves itself from some of the hardest issues, in fact, by not being party to any of these treaties. But here in Europe, we actually have no excuse because we're part of an EU, which is also already established in certain programs and objectives, which we don't follow.
So in EQ Above IQ, the purpose of this show is I want to teach people about the five principles of emotional intelligence, which are self-awareness, self-regulation, empathy, motivation, and social skills. One of the things I like to do with my guests is I ask them this question: what motivated you to do what you're doing? What personally motivated you? What experience in life?
Yeah, I think it was actually, I had an earlier conversation with you that triggered that as well. For me, it's been so normal to have rolled into this work. I don't think I ever intended coming into this work. It was by chance that I didn't get the opportunities that I did at 18 that made me realize that the color of my skin had somehow affected my ability to get the job, which I was incredibly qualified for at that time within the art sector. It made me reflect on the fact that I was a child who had sailed out of an apartheid South Africa in 1977. I was 7 years old. And we went to Australia for a new life. Was also in not just that, but it was also that lives were a little bit threatened too. It's like how a lot of Americans leave America at this point in time as well, in a little bit of fear. It was the same thing. My father wanted a better life. My mother wanted a better life for us. So we left, but we faced the similar problems in Australia, but then, well, actually not even so much in a different way. There was its own ways of structural exclusion. In South Africa, it was law. So you couldn't bathe in the same area, you couldn't shop in the same shops, and you just didn't meet each other. I mean, your beaches were just separated into three different sections. So if you've grown up like that, and that's your norm, you don't reflect on it as a small child because it's law. You come to a place where it's not law, it's actually against the law to discriminate, and you still get discriminated. It was something very difficult for me to process. I was very verbal about it, but at the same time, I knew I would be sanctioned for having a big mouth. It's not considered in many places, if you were white and you are articulate, you're considered to be articulate. If you're colored and you are articulate, you're perceived to be arrogant or having a big mouth. So I kept my mouth closed because I wanted to be able to still get somewhere. And I think that formed something of the basis of the work that I do. I did not pursue my career in the arts. I think the arts missed me in that sense because I came with so much with such a different background as well. But in that part of the world, being a dancer, being of color, being an artist in any way, whether it be an actor or in films, which I thought would also be my genre. It didn't. I knew that I was not going to get selected despite the fact that I was fairly talented. They kept saying, we didn't ask for a black person. So if I turned up at the audition, it was not the question of, oh, you're good at what you do. We didn't ask for a black person. No, you asked for a type in a casting. You asked for a competent dancer in a ballet. You asked for, for whether you're doing a stage play, if you are going to play Margaret in Taming of the Shrew or whatever, then Okay, you don't associate that with color. So it was in a very young age, a big wake-up call to the fact that color, although we had escaped apartheid, I was never going to escape. It was a little bit frightening. So I escaped Australia altogether.
Okay.
And that's how I
ended up in
Europe.
And you know what's interesting? Yeah, that you know what's very interesting about this? I'm having this conversation. I am a member of this expat group on Facebook, mm-hmm. Black Americans Living Abroad. Mm-hmm. And this has been a huge part of our conversation. It's always the question of, is this place or that place less racist? It's never a question of if it is racist. Mm-hmm. It's already the automatic assumption that wherever you go, that there is going to be some level of racism. And that's really heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we have to raise our children up.
Yeah.
With building good and high self-esteem. But then there's this undercurrent of us actually building resiliency in them to be able to cope with the fact that they're not judged about their character, mm-hmm. or how intelligent they actually are, how academically well they do in school.
Mm-hmm.
They are judged purely based on what they look like. And then, you know, the color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a very difficult, and it's so structurally embedded, mm-hmm. in the system. You know, it's like from education all the way up,
yep.
you know, and in the education here in particular,
mm-hmm.
I find a really appalling.
Yeah,
how they make it,
I mean,
such
even
a
in the 90s
thing.
When I had arrived here, mm-hmm. people had said to me, people who are older than me, remember I was maybe 21 years old when I first arrived here, so there was no internet. I couldn't really search as to, you know, how racist was this place. But that was definitely mm-hmm. a question my father had asked before. What was it like there? I mean, you do know that the Dutch were the crafters of apartheid. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. What do you think might be there? I said, I don't think so, because on my first visit through Europe, I said, I saw a lot of black people and I feel very comfortable within a city that has such a mix, which I did not see mm-hmm. in Australia. And mm-hmm. in the time that I was growing up, it was multicultural, but there was not a lot of dark-skinned people walking around. So, of course, there was a huge comfort to see people of African descent, Suriname descent, Aruban descent. I felt it was, for me, like coming home in some kind of way. There was a bit of Africa here in peoples, and I was really happy about that. So I didn't know what was behind that. And I have to say, the yeah. 90s here were still the tail end of a very good Labour government. So it was a country that prided itself on social welfare, on access, good access to healthcare, affordable healthcare. In fact, you know, we didn't always have access to the top jobs, but there was a certain amount of movement in the fact that a lot of people, even this big city, were very proud of the foreigners that were in the city. They felt proud that mm-hmm. we had made this city so vibrant. There was a certain pride associated mm-hmm. with having foreigners in your city. And that
yes.
slowly dwindled over the course mm-hmm. of the last 20 to 30 years. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of people don't realize that Holland still holds that image sometimes in other countries of being the social
yes.
welfare state. Their old diplomats were considered to be good mediators. They had grown a very good reputation within NATO. So, of course, and within education, everything seemed that the Dutch were quite prominent, and they were, also in terms of emotional intelligence, the ones who had kept it cool for a lot of people. But under the scene, yeah. you know, behind the scenes, under the carpet, very much like the US, there was always a kind of policy that we never knew about, whether it was written or whether yeah. it was an spoken agreement between certain groups. We were not aware of that. But it started to become
yes.
very transparent, I think, more so in the last 10 years. So
okay. And yes, and I've been here just, you know, just a short time, 4 years, and I've always been a little bit taken aback that I don't see any Black doctors, or occasionally I see an Indian mm-hmm. one, but I don't see people of color within the Dutch system
yeah.
that look like me. And I know there has to be qualified people to do
yeah.
that, or people of color. It's sort of like it's a subliminal messaging
yeah.
to our children that you don't get to be in that type of position.
Yeah.
And so I was very, when I met you, I was like, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I also had to put myself,
a black lawyer.
I had to put myself in this position because
yes,
I would
you
not be put
that
in that position. I speak fluent Dutch. I speak it with not such a heavy accent at all. And that was what they always mm-hmm. said when you came to the Netherlands. Do you speak Dutch? How's your Dutch? What's your Dutch? So you go mm-hmm. through that phase of, okay, now I've passed the test. I speak Dutch. I am Dutch. I'm one third Dutch because I've lived an equal part of my life in this country. So it's mm-hmm. for all purposes, I'm Dutch, but I'm still not considered for the top jobs. There's still the concern of having the public relations face as mine or anyone else's of color. Mm-hmm. It's a very huge concern. And there is also a kind of non-acceptance of people who have English as their mother tongue. It's a kind of mm-hmm. ism that we and discrimination that it's not so common that people don't really realize, but it is definitely there. Mm. I see people who have a command of their language as being a threat, mm-hmm. especially when they know how powerful you are in your own language.
Yeah.
There is something
yeah.
in that. Well, and I think that that's held us, even when they separate us into two groups in the Netherlands because of how researchers studied us, which was to consider us all people of migrant background. We're about 24 to 25% in population in this country, but they separate us into groups, non-Western and Western. The preference is clearly non-Western because they consider people from the West have had more privilege, and non-Western meaning more people from the Arab countries, Morocco or Turkey, who had immigrated here. But for me, they will always be more Dutch than me because, and that's why I think in a lot of ways, the preference will always go there because they're more assimilated in the sense of understanding what it is to be Dutch. But at the same time,
well,
they face the same amount of discrimination. They're also not in high numbers.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to say, that even though that might be the case, is it more not because they're accepted, it's more because they're easily boxed and there is an understanding of who they are and they feel like maybe they know their place there.
Yeah.
That's my
feeling. I think they have a higher assimilation rate once in a higher position within an organization because they have the great benefit of maybe not being born outside the country because you're raised and you're Dutch. Mm. So why they're separated in the first place into the category is beyond me because it's like not recognizing someone to be a national of this country is really kind of shocking. Okay, I'm a national of this country and I wasn't born here. Still, there's a little gap between me and the others, but there also shouldn't be. But they say they face that group, so what we call non-Western, face the same amount of discrimination, but they have a larger movement than what we do. So I'm in the minority of a minority. Yeah.
I see. Now, one of the questions that I had for you, you are a mother as well of a little brown boy.
Yeah.
And what has been your experience as far as emotional intelligence? Because what it's been my biggest challenge, and one of the reasons I was motivated to teach emotional intelligence and create mindful storytellers classes was first of all, I knew that there were not a lot of teachers in the classroom that looked like me. And I feel like it's vital for children of all cultural backgrounds to see people that look like them, you know, in power positions of, I want to say power, but of more of authority. So educators, doctors, lawyers. And so when I didn't see that, I chose that I was going to be a part of that because I am a teacher. I have a teaching background and I've lived all over the world teaching. Emotional intelligence, I feel like, is something that is lacking globally.
Yeah.
But as a parent, how's that been for you? what has been your challenges and what have been your, let's just, you know, what have been the positives? Yeah. If there had,
there's been very few positives. The only positives, I guess, is within this family. We are a mixed race family, so for us, the principles that you know around emotional intelligence is the way we live our life. That's why we have a broad friendship circle. But if I look at, compare that way of life and that way of thinking, one of the reasons we left South Africa when James was so small is because we knew he would face also a certain amount of stigma within his own background, his own tribal background. And if you look at within the South African education system, in the private schools, in the area that we were living, they were run by white people. I felt that to be very strange to continue to live in a country where we'd be continuously separated by where you come from, in terms of your heritage, and then to be on the lower end of the spectrum, I couldn't accept that. I just felt that it was also, besides the fact that I had to move forward with my work and get out of the country, I think it was a good, we thought it was a good opportunity to come back. And why? Because I thought Amsterdam is a multicultural city. In the 10 years that we've gone, we for sure there's an education system now with all those young kids that were growing up while I was an adult. They were growing up and they would have all got their teaching diplomas and be teaching. That 24% of people with a migrant background is nowhere reflected in any Dutch school. You have, a religious denominational schools, so they will have teachers that are all Muslim, or you have Catholic schools where the teachers are, you know, all Catholic. Maybe that's even more diverse. I haven't seen inside those schools, but Catholicism is a very, goes across very many cultures. So maybe it is more multicultural. I'm not sure. But if I looked at just the public school system, I was fairly shocked to see not one black male in there, yet so many Suriname men had been leaders in my time. I had wondered where they had gone in the last 10 years, why they were not standing in front of that classroom teaching. There were no people of color. There was not. James has not had one teacher that had a migrant background. They've all been white females. And white females, if you talk about emotional intelligence, in this system have not been trained at all to be aware of their own way of behaving and their own biases, which are sometimes unconscious. Some of them are very conscious. Let's not say everything is unconscious, because I feel we let off a lot of people on this unconscious bias stuff. But the way they treat young black males in comparison to white young females is a world of difference. And if they can't see that, then they've got blind spots. That means the system had not catered for people to be working. And we're not talking about the 24%, because in this city, we're 51%. 51% with a migrant background, and you will put a child of color as a minority, make him feel a minority in his class, is an absolute shame. It's a scandal, actually. I don't think that anyone sees it or feels it as that level, because privilege is a very fine thing to be able to hear me say something like that. And people think, oh, take it easy. At least he has an education. So this is a very hard thing to reconcile with, knowing how many more rights we have and he has. And there's a blatant racism too. So in terms of emotional intelligence, it's not part and parcel of teacher training, which it should be. I mean, what I teach in emotional intelligence is for leaders to understand and have awareness of that, because you'll be leading in the future very, very diverse teams. To do that, you will have to have an awareness of intercultural relations. But if you're a teacher in a city that has 51% of people with children with a foreign background or more, then you've failed, actually, if you cannot recognize it or have your teachers trained very, very quickly. Equality is not just a word. It is how you express yourself.
Yes. And you know what? And the truth is, too, is that when they're confronted with it, they become very frail. And they become very like, oh, my God. I mean, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with these types of teachers who are quite robotic, who are considered good teachers, but they are totally unconscious or unaware that they're coming across as rude, abusive, unkind, and definitely more toward children of color. You know, I've been to now three different schools. And because of what I do, I'm so super aware the energy of a person. And you know, what's amazing is that when I started teaching my course, Mindful Storytellers, I had people come to me, white and black, saying, I don't care what you're teaching. I'm just glad to see there's a person.
Yeah, I mean, this is a common.
So there is definitely absolutely. There is definitely a desire for it to be there.
One of the most basic strategies in the world to combat fear of unconscious bias, because conscious racism is there. It's conscious racism is the higher percentage. People would love to call it bias. Bias is a very small part. Yeah. Conscious racism is the reason why people are structurally excluded. Yes. They are so unaware to such a large extent, so unaware of the rights of the child that is in front of them. They are so unaware of their own limitations. And when by you raising it, you raise only defense. So one of the greatest conscious strategies for racism is exposure. Had you put someone in the top position in the country, in a ministerial job, your role model would have already been there. Your respect for that person would not be based on a dialogue of understanding them, but watching them. Your teacher being put in a position, in a certain position in a school, you won't even have to have that conversation, because exposure would allow you to feel comfort in the presence of that person. We would realize we are very similar. The same for a four-year-old child. Children are not born really choosing on color. But by the age of four, a white child is more likely to choose someone of their upbringing, so who's been their parent, their caretaker. They will choose the color more of the dominant caretaker. So even if the mother was white and the father is black, the child would most likely still choose for the white mother. So the child will gravitate to that person of color. If that child is not exposed to more children of color, they will become more and more afraid. This is what nature's doing already. People say that children don't see color, but in fact, by the age of four, they start to. But here's an interesting fact. Children of color have no preference. But this says a lot about us and how we become leaders. There's an inbuilt emotional intelligence, which I find fascinating. I'm not going to go into a race theory and say who's better. But let's be honest about it, because when we have risen to the jobs that we have gone to, we've been able to have the privilege to enter. We haven't been discriminatory, because it's not in us to be like that. We're fairly fair. Can you imagine a black child doesn't discriminate on skin color at all? At all. Black children just don't. Colored children don't. But white children do. That means that the onus rests so much with the system in terms of exposure to put us in certain positions and to put those children also in closer to each other in certain schools, instead of saying that's the only black child, that's the only colored child. Exposure is a counter strategy. But if you haven't had exposure, then this child will automatically grow up to be a white person who will choose for their own affinity bias. Right. It's they're programmed in it.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's affinity bias. And the thing is that it doesn't make the kid a bad kid. It doesn't make the kid this. But what it does is just reinforces the supremacy and all the negativity around that. And then it makes them feel that they can do and say what they want, because that's what the
culture is teaching. And the education system has an onus to live out to the to equality. If you believe in it in schools, then this is one of the ways that you live it out. But
you cannot be emotionally intelligent and still have racism in you. It's just impossible. And that's why it's such a huge focus for me, because I did an episode last week about George Floyd and why emotional intelligence would have saved his life. There is no way that a person can arrest or continue to beat or do anything if they're like, where am I in my body? I'm feeling so angry. Or I feel fearful. Or where? And then taking all those steps down the line and taking all those principles in account, you no longer can have that anger or that fear.
But it's the same as the teaching profession, America's system. Yeah. And I think here also to a certain degree, it's not based on any ethical codes. The police training in America is not based on any ethical codes. If I don't know whether you know, like in England, even though it's not all right there either, but when you enter the force, you're taught the codes of community policing. So it's basically a system of serving and protecting, serving. Serving means
that's what that code is supposed to be in the US.
In front of you will tell you what they need from you. If you are going in to protect, yes, you will have to use certain force and certain things and whatever, but you're still looking at the community as a whole and protection. Same with teachers. There's certain codes in certain countries in which teachers operate into. What I have felt is if we're talking about emotional intelligence, there are no ethical codes. Even in business, people are not adhering to anything along the lines of morality and ethics. That's something that's disappeared entirely from this world. I think it's a shocking shame because previously it was still there. Corporate social responsibility and all of that also arose out of ethics, the concept of ethics. It's the same also in some of the better schools and better universities in the world. Ethics form the basis of how even teachers related to their students. But that's lacking. That police force has no code of ethics. When you enter the police force, you have to be told, you will serve and protect. Those codes are not there. If you look at the Peelian codes, you know, developed by Sir Robert Peel back in God knows when, I think the 1800s, if you ever even just have a quick look at them, it's very relevant to this very day, but nobody's operating on codes. If a sergeant major, even in an army, was operating on a set of codes, we would have different people attracted in working in protection services. We have different people attracted to the school system. But to have that means that that top person in that top position has to be exuding all of those codes. We just don't have the right leaders. The leaders are not emulating. They're doing it half-baked. I can't say that not all of them.
No, I would agree with your first beginning of that statement. They're not, because the system has been changed to that profit is the priority, not the people. And there's also, it is constantly fed through us, to us, through the media, through the way movies are made, everything. It's about being the top dog financially, to be the richest. And it has nothing to do with the character of people and how you treat people and what's right. And, I don't want to say all, but it's about blow up, shoot them down, you know. And if you think about what's been coming out, I mean, just going back to you and you originally wanting to be in the arts and being an accomplished actress and things like that, and not being given the opportunity to be in those roles to show that people of colors can do these things. And I will say that that has improved.
Sure. In the United States, over the last definitely.
United States only. I don't see that here. I don't see that here at all.
They expect me to go into the alternative arts and not the mainstream. I was a mainstream ballet, I was mainstream film, I was mainstream theater. I was not fringe.
Yeah. And so that's the thing, is like, it's all about what a society wants to perpetuate in order to get to the place of being emotionally intelligent. And you know, I don't want to beat up on Holland too much. It just so happens to be where we are at the moment, but it's just globally
an issue. If you relate emotional intelligence to leadership, which is what I'm trying to do most of the time, I preach it, I teach it. But what I do know for a fact,
and you live it.
I mean, it's part of, I mean, you can't have an inclusive and diverse team without an inclusive leader. An inclusive leader has certain characteristics and traits that they need to always be busy with every single day to make sure that people feel included and have this sense of belonging. But also within their processes, within their operational context, they have to also understand what inclusion is. And for that, emotional intelligence is also very, very important because it creates a level playing field of equality for everyone to be promoted, to have their voice included in changing a product, marketing a product, going into a different region. All of those things are very important to have collective intelligence from a team. So emotional intelligence plays a huge role within businesses entirely. But what I know from a society perspective and a business perspective, sanctions, we've moved away from a sanction penalty-like world. Previously, we were sanctioned fairly heavily for a lot of things. Schools were under more control of their government. Schools have become now more autonomous. They fought for it. But that autonomy has created its own disaster because now they are almost impossible to be held accountable for their behaviors, for what's going on. But even if we were to hold them accountable on some kind of tribune or tribunal or whatever it is, what is the sanction? Because people don't change their behavior without sanction. This is why our penal systems were so strong. You go to jail for 25 years if you have murdered someone, you know, whatever. This is why we set things up this way. But there's no sanctions in the business community for committing crimes, whether it be crimes against children of color. Where is the sanction? For example, if a school was found out that they had discrimination cases brought up against them by five or six people in the year, should that school not be on some kind of watch list? Should there not be someone or a task team that visits the schools every time and say, what's going on in here? You combat racism through strategies. Yeah. Same in companies. If a company has shown to have a certain amount of cases brought forward every year in terms of discrimination on all grounds, so where do we take emotional intelligence to when we have it? It's still a sense of accountability because we need systems and above people to hold them to account. But where's the sanction? So is a company sanctioned? Could we sanction a company? Is something to consider in terms of new legislation in the future if we're going to legislate equality, because I think that's where we're moving as a second step, as a counter-strategy to racism, is actually legislating equality acts. And I think that one of those will have to be sanctions. You cannot continue to be racist in 2020 and not have a financial or social sanction within your community, because we are relying on goodwill of people in a country that, like all across the world, whose greatest threat is far right extremism more than it is jihadism. We have to consider the fact that we're dealing with that. We're not. Dialogue is a very small part. Actually, dialogue, I'm a bit tired of the dialogue. The education will have to continue. But I think where we're going to in the largest percentage is creating efficient systems of monitoring, of complaints handling, and of sanctions. So for me, the work is there because we can put as much as we want into the effort of emotional intelligence. But for the ones who fall through, for the ones who fail our children, how are they held to account when they're so autonomous?
Okay, exactly. And that's, you know, you bring up a very important and valid point, and one that is constantly tried to be pushed aside here. When I said, for example, what are your protocols for bullying? I was literally laughed at and made fun of, that I would actually ask for there to be something in place to handle that type of situation with my son. And he was bullied, you know, and a lot of the parents are asking for those things, but you're like, even the word protocol, it's because for some reason, and I've heard this, they say, well, we're all adults and we can handle it. But the truth is that, no, you're not all adults. You're all children pretending to be adults. You're all people moving your ideas, beliefs, and traumas onto other people. And until you can be self-aware that that is the case, you're going to just keep on passing on the same trauma, the same ideals, the same things mm-hmm. that are not working globally. Maybe yep. they're working for you. Maybe they're working for white supremacy, but exactly. the world is not
That's
all
why
white.
You need to create underneath them and above them bias-free systems. For example, if a complaint came through,
yeah.
a complaint needs to be lodged actually with a national service that would be able to then draw out data at the end of the year to be able to tell you that school had a high amount of complaints. And the complaint is not even known first in the beginning by the head of the school or the teachers or whatever, so that they have an initial capture of what's going on. When you report at the end of the year, which every school has to, why is there not a report made on where is the anti-discrimination policy? Where is the guidelines for teachers handling bullying? Where is the teacher training results for intercultural intelligence? Where there should be a report put in every year that benefits a multicultural society. We preach all equality. We could sign the racism conferences, a declaration. We can sign all these treaties all over the world, but putting it into effective action are things like this that are fairly simple. It doesn't even create a greater onus on the Department of Education. You'll just have a team that constantly monitors and betters the system by knowing where are the points of action for these schools. And if they don't live up to it, they should be sanctioned.
Yes, and they should be sanctioned. And wow, what a great conversation that we're having. I'm so excited that I'm having you on the show and that, you know, we got a chance to talk about this subject. Yeah. This subject has been weighing on me very heavily as I put my kid through the education system here. And I'm trying to figure out strategies in order to create emotional intelligence and through the school system. And unfortunately, I'd like to think that it would be the onus of the individuals to do it. And I am working to do courses and classes to teach the individuals, because it does have to be the choice in the end. But the truth is that when a system is set up only to serve a few, you Absolutely. Do have to put in policies
I think
to push
that, time
that
is
agenda
coming.
Forward. And oh,
it's overdue, but there was no opportunity for it. It's long overdue, but there was no opportunity because that door was always slammed straight in our face. It's an immediate slam in the face.
Immediately.
But now, after what had occurred in the last few weeks, and Amsterdam had its own small revolution as well, you cannot avoid this anymore. Mm-hmm. It is now out in a way that you can't avoid the conversation if somebody had come up and said something. But I still need to see collective action on this, because you can't expect singular parents to be fighting this battle every day when it's their right as parents to have this already ready within a school system, within a democratic society. Somebody has to legislate this very, very soon. It's just putting a few things in place. There are safeguards, and a reporting system, a mechanism, and a task team to review it is not rocket science. I think it is the very next step is to start within the schools, because what we're dealing with in companies are very, very difficult things. I think the easiest place is to begin is where it all starts, is in our schools.
And I love this, you know, before I moved here, one of the things that I heard about Amsterdam and about the Netherlands in particular is like, they're so tolerant. And I never
they don't
liked
understand
that word.
That word. It means something slightly, there's a slight difference in the translation of that in English and Dutch. Yeah. For us, it has a totally negative connotation. Yeah. It's
completely
put up with.
Negative. It means that you
are bothered.
It
means to put up with. Yeah.
And I'm going to tolerate you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to put up with you. And what we need on a global level is acceptance. Accepting that I do not have to look like you. Accepting that I do not have to do the same things that you do. And I don't even have to think like you do. But you do have to give me respect, and you do have to treat me as an equal, and you do have to treat me with the same level honor that I will do upon you. You know what I mean? So, but anyway,
thank you.
I'm going to wrap it up right now. You were a wealth of information. I'm sure that a lot of people listening to this podcast would like to reach out to you. So where can
that's
where
through
can
my business and
you?
Through the business website, which is Catalyst Consulting. .nl, and then there's all the contact information there as well.
Okay, wonderful. And I'm going to ask you to have a wonderful, blessed day. Thank you for sharing part of your journey and your experience with us to help us better understand why you do what you do and what your purpose is. And please continue, because we need more people like you to move us as a culture and a society forward. And
hey, you too.
To teach emotional intelligence.
Continue doing what you're doing. And thank you for giving us also a platform for to be able to share our knowledge and experience.
All right. You have a
you too.
Wonderful
Thanks,
rest
Tree.
Of your day.
You too. Bye.
Thanks, Jerry. Wow, what a great discussion with Jerry. I really appreciated her perspective on emotional intelligence and equality. As a trainer, she knows the importance of reaching people when they're younger, as well as kind of reprogramming our brain. You know, our society has programmed us a certain way in order for us to get to a place where we want to be as a society and a collaborative and equal society. We need to change that programming. So let's do it with emotional intelligence. And don't forget to go to thisreallifebooks.com to find books for your children to discuss emotional intelligence and real life issues that are happening in the world right now. And having deep discussions around how they can be more emotionally intelligent and have more self-awareness and learn how to regulate their emotions better and also have more empathy for their peers. I think that we're all just children walking around in adult suits trying to figure everything out and pretending we have it figured out while we're just spreading our trauma. So let's correct course as a culture, as a society, and let's come together and create a place where everyone is equal. And let's reform education. Let's make it a better place where children are respected and they're not in just another cog in the wheel to basically reinforce cultural norms that aren't serving us well. So let's be more emotionally intelligent. Check out This Real Life Books. I also have some great t-shirts to remind us that I learn respect from your respect. And these are the things that will help us move us along as a society, as a culture, to make it better. Thank you for listening to EQ Above IQ, Parenting with Emotional Intelligence and Healing the Inner Child. And I hope you have a blessed day.